Welcome to another episode in the Neon Jazz interview series with modern jazz drummer Zach Albetta. He was born and raised in the arts-rich region of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and made his way into the jazz studies program under the great Bobby Watson at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. During his 7 years stay in Kansas City, he got a solid education in both the classroom and a very, very thriving jazz scene full of talent. These days, he is residing in Los Angeles, or Beverly Hills to be exact. He's very busy with a solid lineup of gigs, including being a part of Disneyland's Five and Dime Band. He loves jazz and all the virtues that have come along with it. During an open interview, he spoke about many things. Dig it.
So, first of all, thank you for taking a little time to talk with us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, man. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, the first thing I'm going to ask, what has been going on with you lately?
Most recently, I became the drummer for a group called the Jennifer Keith Sextet here in L.A. Jennifer Keith is a fantastic singer, and her band leader is a tenor sax player named Mondo Durrani, who is he was the founding member of Royal Crown Revue back in the 90s.
Yeah.
So he built this group around her, since joining that group, I joined that group in September of 2014, and we've played at the Cosmopolitan in Las Vegas. We did the Catalina Jazz Festival in, I think it was October. That's one of my main gigs. These days, they're planning a new record and hopefully some tour dates later in 2015. So that's been really fun. I've been playing with another swing band called Fat Cat Swinger. It's kind of a party band. Me and another drummer kind of split that drum chair depending on who's available. The constant for me for the last 3 years almost has been playing at Disneyland in a group called the Five and Dime Band, which is like a quintet plus a singer. It's kind of, you know, a 1930s Ella vibe.
Yeah.
Those are what's keeping me busy these days.
Very cool. Lucky three right there.
Yeah.
So you picked the drums. Did you pick the drums or did they pick you?
I think they definitely picked me. My earliest memories are of wanting to play drums. My two earliest memories are wanting to play drums and just being in love with food. My adult life is my profession is drums, and my hobby, my other passion is cooking and eating and drinking.
Very nice. Very nice.
Yeah.
And speaking of that, having a palate for things that are tasty, you grew up in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
I did.
In regards to that area, how did that area give you that appreciation for the arts and jazz?
Well, Santa Fe is a really unique place in the country. It's one of those few cities in the U.S. that actually predates the U.S. It's the oldest city in the U.S. It was founded by Spaniards in, I think, the 16th century. A couple of years ago, my wife and I took like a week-long vacation to New Orleans. Even though there are many things that are different about the two cities, New Orleans really reminded us of Santa Fe in that it felt like it predated the U.S. It's a lot of European influence, a lot of Catholic influence. Growing up in Santa Fe, just, you know, of course I didn't realize it at the time because wherever you grow up just seems normal. I was exposed to a lot of art and a lot of food and a lot of culture that I wouldn't have been if I had grown up almost anywhere else in the U.S. My parents are both very artistically inclined. There was always all kinds of music around me and all kinds of art, and they're both pretty adventurous cooks. I started eating weird stuff you know, from a young age. I was the kid at school who showed up. You know, everybody else had like the Iron Kiss bread with the peanut butter, the Peter Pan peanut butter, and you know, the Coke. And I was the kid that had like hummus. So that kind of you know, curiosity and appreciation for different things came at an early age for me.
Right on. So your path wove its way into Kansas City. How did that happen?
It was kind of a fate, if you believe in that sort of thing, I guess. I as a high school student in Santa Fe, I developed a relationship with Jim Snell, who at the time was the percussion professor at the University of New Mexico. He recruited me to go to UNM, but right before my freshman year started, he left. We just kind of lost touch for a while. I spent a couple years at UNM. I transferred to Ball State in Indiana to finish my bachelor's degree. 5 years later, I was at a big percussion convention, and just ran into Jim Snell by chance. And at the time I was, you know, starting to look for grad schools to go to, and he said, well, you know, come check us out in Kansas City. So I auditioned, and was awarded the graduate assistantship for the percussion department. And that's what brought me to Kansas City.
So how long did you spend, how many years were you in Kansas City?
I was there from 2003 to 2010, and I was in school for, the first 4 years.
So in 7 years, kind of give me a synopsis of what you saw, what was kind of your timeline of being here in Kansas City?
Well, it kind of shifted my focus from classical percussion, which I had, you know, that was my focus in my undergrad and for a good part of graduate school. But it shifted my focus back onto the drum set, which was my first love. I finished my classical percussion master's degree. But as I was nearing the end of that, I was thinking, you know, cause I had been in the big band and jazz combos studying with Bobby. And as I was finishing my classical degree, I was thinking, man, I wish I had more time to just hang out with Bobby. So I decided to, get a second master's degree in jazz and studio music, and I cared not at all about the piece of paper. It was really just to spend more time with Bobby and with the other jazz students and with, you know, guys like Doug Allwater and the adjunct faculty that the jazz program at UMKC has. So Bobby was extremely cool about it and really kind of bent over backwards to get me some financial aid so that I could basically get that second master's degree for free.
So what was it about Bobby as a person and as a teacher that was so alluring that made you want to, that's a pretty big commitment to stick around for another chunk of education. What was it about him that moved you so much?
He's just a magnetic personality, first of all. I mean, it, you know, If neither one of you were holding instruments, if you're just having a beer, he's just an extremely magnetic person to be around. He's inspiring. You never know when you know, a pearl of wisdom is going to fly out of his mouth. I felt like that. You know, at the end of 2 years. After my first master's degree, I felt like I had just scratched the surface of what Bobby had to offer. I knew there was a lot more wisdom and, you know, knowledge and fun that I had to mine out of him still.
So in your time that you were here, you played with Bobby, the 18th mm-hmm. and Vine Big Band, Karen mm-hmm. Allison, Clint Ashlock, the list of those cats in Kansas City that are really keeping, kind of bringing in a renaissance and keeping the KC scene very fluid. You played with these guys. What did that time really teach you and give to your jazz backbone?
It made me realize that young jazz players can really write their own ticket in terms of the music they want to make. You know, the time I was in Kansas City, I think, like you said, was a renaissance in Kansas City, and it's still happening, I think. And I think previous guests of yours on the podcast have pointed to Bobby as the catalyst for that, and I think it's absolutely right. So it was interesting. When I first got there, you know, I was very familiar with Kansas City's history and its place in jazz history. And when I first got there, I felt like it, you know, Kansas City was still dominated by that history. It was very much a straight ahead town. You know, that's what the audiences liked. That's what the musicians were playing. And that's still there. And I hope that always remains there. But during my 7 years there, a bigger and bigger piece of the scene seemed to be represented by people my age or around my age, who were just coming up with new things, original music, original compositions, you know, cool fusion projects, not fusion in the sense of, you know, headhunters or whatever, but, just, you know, mixing different influences, Latin music, hip hop. You know, I've always said that the music scene in Kansas City is very incestuous in the best possible way. Because, you know, the different circles of musicians, you know, find each other and dream up projects to do together. So the longer I was there, the more that, seemed to happen. It really gave me a taste for, you know, bringing jazz to new audiences or, you know, bringing jazz audiences to another kind of music.
Absolutely. So now that you've been away from Kansas City for a bit, you spent some good quality time here. What's the best thing about Kansas City?
Oh, man. Well, for me, you know, it's the circle of friends that I have there. You know, just what I call my chosen family. That's very personal to me, but, I feel like I really became an adult in Kansas City. And that's where I formed, you know, some relationships that are going to be lifelong. As far as a more objective aspect of Kansas City, I would say that it's just this bastion of hipness in a sea of sort of Midwestern, blandness, in my opinion. And I realize I may be offending, people, who grew up and live in the Midwest or whatever, but you know, I traveled around to various cities that surround Kansas City, and for my money, there's nowhere closer than Chicago that's as cool as Kansas City. There's amazing food, there's amazing music, there's amazing art, there's a lot of civic pride. And it just, it's kind of a little oasis in my mind, in the middle of the great big Midwest.
Right on. So you're no stranger, obviously, to traveling, and you grew up in Santa Fe. Was mm-hmm. there any kind of culture shock when you got to LA and got settled in after living in Kansas City for that long?
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. First of all, just the sheer size of it, you know, there's 16 million people in this area. You know, getting around is just a whole game in and of itself. Being surrounded by so many different cultures from all over the world. You know, my wife and I say that, well, like, one of the things we love about LA is that you can be standing in line behind someone who's talking on their cell phone and you have no idea what language they're speaking. Like, you know, if it's Spanish or German or even Japanese, or, you know, so you can kind of pick it out. But, right. There are some languages here in some communities where, you know, I couldn't even hazard a guess as to where they're from and what language they're speaking. So that's exciting. It's you know, it's a global city. It's very much plugged into the rest of the world. There was a special kind of culture shock for me because when I moved here, I moved in with my girlfriend, who is now my wife. The apartment that she fell in love with when she moved here, happened to be in Beverly Hills. Mm-hmm. That wasn't by design. She didn't intend to move into Beverly Hills, but, she just found this great little apartment that she loved. And we live in Beverly Hills, and it's, you know, kind of the poor section where the regular apartments are, but, we live in Beverly Hills, and I worked a couple of restaurant jobs, right near Rodeo Drive. This was at a time in my life. My first year and a half in LA was rough financially. It was also the height of the kind of Occupy Wall Street fervor. The difference in lifestyle between someone like me and the people that I was serving in Beverly Hills was in stark contrast. It was a little bit of a psychological challenge to get through that.
Well, it's all growth after all, realistically.
Indeed. Yeah, absolutely.
I guess that's my next big question for you is that you spent your life dabbling in art that's based on improv, and it seems to me working for Disneyland and the Five and Dime Band would have to be one of the more regulated, structured kind of gigs to get, but probably pretty steady pay at the same time.
Yes, both of those things are very, very true. And, getting that gig and working for a huge company like Disney required a lot of growth on my part and a change in perspective. It is very structured, and you have directors and maintenance choreographers and musical directors and stage managers to answer to. And there was a time, I think, 6 or 7 years ago or the time I was in Kansas City, I would have had trouble with it. It would have seemed like too many hoops to jump through. Working in restaurants for a year and a half kind of cured me of, bucking against that. I'm really grateful to have that gig. There's tons of great musicians that I've met, and it's led to other opportunities outside of Disney. You never know how long a gig like that is going to last. I always say, on the one hand, I would love for that gig to last forever, and on the other hand, I don't want to need it forever.
Right.
I think most of the time I keep a pretty good balance of keeping my foot on the gas outside the park and looking for other opportunities to make a living and play music that fulfills me. There are times once in a while where some time will go by and it's like I haven't really done anything other than Disney for a little while here. I better got to get back out there and show my face.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, people have flashpoints with jazz music where they hear a musician, whether it's live or on an album, and it really gets them under the jazz spell. Did you have a moment like that?
I really didn't. I've been on a journey with jazz, and I guess a little bit away from jazz since I got out of school. One of the things I realized about myself is that I care more about playing drums than I do about playing jazz. Drum set was my first love musically. And the reason I got into jazz was because when I went to college, that was the vehicle that I could continue playing drum set. I developed an intellectual and an academic appreciation for jazz. And there was some of it and still is some of it that I'm genuinely in love with. But you hear those stories about, you know, I heard this record or I saw this person live or, and it just changed everything. But that never really happened to me. I think my journey into jazz was more gradual. I never amassed a huge jazz record collection. I was pretty picky and choosy about what I brought into my music collection. Like I said, there is some jazz music and some artists that really touch me on an emotional level. But one of the things I've realized over the past few years is that, you know, while I appreciate it as a musician, I appreciate it on an intellectual level. I don't appreciate it all as a listener.
Right.
So that might not be what some of your listeners want to hear.
No. Every single bio is different. You know?
Yeah.
It's like you're saying, you know, 6 years ago you wouldn't have taken a gig with Disney. And I keep thinking about all the jazz bios, like, say, Ella Fitzgerald, her beginnings were really grim, but she always said in interviews later on she wouldn't trade any of that in because it made her dig within to find that place to bring about the music she made, you know?
Right,
so,
right.
It's the beauty of life. We're all different. We all have our own paths,
yeah.
You know? So.
And part of that was actually Bobby. You know, Bobby kind of made it okay to not like something or to call something out or to say the emperor has no clothes. I remember one time we were in an improv class that Bobby did, and we were having this discussion about, you know, I guess it was a discussion about playing outside versus playing inside. And Bobby said, you know, anybody can play something nobody understands. And he was talking about improvising, but I that really struck a chord with me in terms of all music and all aspects of being a musician. I want to play music that is accessible to people other than jazz musicians. That's to me, Bobby is one of the jazz artists that is able to please both parties. You know, the hardcore jazzers are really into it, but people who don't listen to jazz very often are also compelled by it because Bobby's music has hooks, it has grooves, it has strong melodies, and it's accessible to anybody, really. So that's something I've really kept with me. Am I making music that a lot of people can enjoy and not just preaching to the choir?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, what's the nicest thing a fan has ever said to you? Or the nicest group, like the feeling you got from a crowd in your life?
Let me see. The compliment that I like getting most from either a fan or a fellow musician is when they say, man, playing with you feels great.
Yeah.
Or when a fan says, we just had a great time. I appreciate it when somebody will reference, you know, a famous drummer that I remind them of or something on that level. But really all I'm after from, like I said, from fellow musicians or from listeners is, that was great. Playing with you, listening to you, just, it was a great night.
So speaking of listening to musicians, who were some of the drummers or jazz cats that really moved you and wanted you to, you know, play in a certain way or really get into it the way you have?
I've gone through kind of a progression of a few guys since I was in college. The first guy that really kind of blew my mind was Peter Erskine. And actually that was kind of a jazz moment for me. You talked about was there a catalyst moment or something. When I was in Indiana in my undergrad, I went to the Jazz Kitchen in Indianapolis to see the Peter Erskine Trio. And uh, ju- just the subtlety and the understated nature of his playing really switched things around for me, because, you know, I thought that jazz was defined by guys like Tony Williams and Elvin Jones, and you know, the more kind of active, bombastic, expressive playing, and Peter played mostly brushes for two sets, very few swing tunes, you know, so I really got into Peter after that, just kind of studying the minimalism of his playing. After that, I kind of went the opposite direction and got really into Bill Stewart, because Bill is just such a unique voice on the drums, the way he orchestrates the drum set and the vocabulary that he uses on the drums really kind of blew my mind open. I spent an entire summer with the John Scofield Trio CD en route in my car. And anytime I was in the car, that CD was playing, digging on Bill Stewart. And then, after that, I really got into Keith Carlock, who is not, you know, a straight ahead jazz drummer per se. He plays a lot of, you know, improvised music. But again, the vocabulary he uses and just kind of the character of his grooves, I found really unique. And he was also someone who, I got a lot from technically. He has a kind of a unique setup. The way he sets up the drums, he plays traditional grip. He tilts the snare drum way forward, you know, kind of like the old school guys did. His rack toms are basically parallel with the floor. Where, you know, usually the rack toms are tilted toward the drummer, but he's got them, you know, almost flat. And his floor toms, are tilted away from him, like the snare drum. And at the time, I was very conscious about my posture behind the kit. I tried that kind of setup, and it made me realize that it really forced me to sit up straight, and be balanced behind the kit. So, you know, the setup I use, currently is a kind of a less extreme version of that. But studying his playing really kind of moved my playing and my physicality forward, I think. And now I'm back to Erskine.
so very cool.
So yeah, people ask me sometimes, like, who are the drummers that you love? Who are the old school cats that you know? And I feel kind of guilty, because, you know, I appreciate and love all the old cats, Max Roach and Tony Williams and Elvin and all those guys. But, you know, they haven't really influenced me as much as, guys that are still alive, basically.
Yeah. Without a doubt.
So I think that's another thing that I feel kind of guilty about, and like maybe my jazz cred isn't in good order, is because I haven't studied every Tony Williams record. I haven't studied every Elvin Jones record, but for whatever reason, the modern guys just kind of struck a chord with me more.
Yeah, well, sounds like it's working for you, for sure.
I hope so, yeah.
What's the greatest thing about getting up every day?
I get to play drums for a living, man. That's the opportunity that moving to L.A. has afforded me. You know, there are a lot of musicians who... in addition to playing, they'll do some sort of teaching or some sort of writing or some sort of non-musical work. And, you know, I've done that in the past, but, since I was a kid, my goal has been, I want to make 100% of my living playing drums. And, you know, I get to do that for the time being, at least. So yeah, I'm really grateful for that every day.
To beat back the misery of L.A. traffic, what's the number one activity you do?
Podcasts.
Nice.
Definitely. And, you know, I feel guilty as a musician and as a jazz musician, because, I, you know, there's part of me that's saying, like, you should be listening to every jazz podcast and every drum podcast and, and just, you know, constantly studying and blah, blah, blah. But really, I listen to, you know, WTF with Marc Maron, and I listen to food podcasts, and I listen to NPR stuff. And, you know, I just think that I need to be a person as well as a drummer. So yeah, podcasts really help kind of fight the urge to start screaming and shaking your steering wheel.
That's right. So do you have an album that's in the works that you're thinking about putting out sometime soon?
Under my own name?
Yeah.
Not at all. Not at all. That's another thing that I've realized about myself as a musician, is that I'm not the kind of musician that is a prolific outputter of original content. You know, I've done some composition and I enjoy arranging. I did a lot of arranging for Shay Estes when I played with her in Kansas City. You know, one of the things I realized about myself is that I am a sideman. You know, I am not Brad Cox. I am the guy that Brad Cox needs to help his vision, you know, come on stage. I enjoy collaborating and you know, adding my skills and my perspective and my craft to a project more than I enjoy, you know, being in charge of the project or dreaming up the project.
Sure. Let's say in 10 years from now, we get back on the phone and we talk and we catch up with what's going on. What are you going to want to tell me about? What are you looking at things that may happen, not even 10, maybe 5 years from now? What do you want to see happen?
I would like to have a greater body of recorded material. I've done some recording, some for groups like Shay's group and some, for more commercial endeavors. But I would like to increase my portfolio of recorded material. And, I'd also like to have some more traveling under my belt. I've gotten to do a little bit, the two things that I wanted to, those are the two things that I wanted to focus on, and kind of the reasons I moved to LA is that I wanted to record more and I wanted to travel more. And since I've been here, like I said, I've gotten to do some of that. I would definitely like to have done, more of both of those things in 5 or 10 years.
Very cool. So if we had to condense you down, Zach, and figure out who you are and what motivates you, in the length of a tweet, tell me who you are.
Man, again, this answer would have been different, you know, 6 or 7 years ago. 6 or 7 years ago, I would have said, you know, drummer, unique voice, musician, artist, blah, blah, blah. But now I mean, it sounds kind of cheesy, but I really think I'm Christina's husband. That's what I want to be good at. I'm human and husband first. Musician and drummer second.
Right on. That's a perfect way to end right there, Zach. Thank you for opening up and giving me some of your time.
Thank you so much, man.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in L.A., Kansas City, and spots all over America, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Zach for his time and passion for the jazz craft. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino on the iTunes Store, or you can always visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.